address this point about the foundation. One of the reasons that I can say that is that I'm actually not going to really talk about the foundations in a way that commits me to any particular one. So in that way, one can think about the foundation, which is presumably there, that one is trying to reach. I'm not going to put forward a personal attempt to solve foundational problems in any comprehensive way. Rather, I was told that it's nice to give a talk once here, and I'm going to try to show why I'm interested in the particular problems that, if time allows, I will show in some detail that tend to be actually rather small technical exercises, but ones that reflect on elements of the history of one of the particular attempts to solve the problem of understanding quantum mechanics and interpreting quantum mechanics, which is the decoherence approach, which I don't commit myself to in any way whatsoever, but which I think is moving in a very good direction recently, not on the interpretational side, but in terms of the questions, the practical questions, that it's led people to look at, particularly people in the Jurek group, of course. So I have the subtitle here, Toward the Quantum Classical Transition, which means that I won't be talking specifically about the quantum classical transition itself in terms of new results, but rather the question of the nature of that transition, the nature of the quantum classical boundary or lack thereof, will be what I believe one will learn about by following the tack of the decoherence approach, leaving aside its philosophical baggage, so to speak. So that's the sort of broader context in which some of the problems in decoherence influenced systems that I'll be talking about at the end come. So, of course, in the decoherence approach, the idea is that one is supposed to learn about what quantum mechanics is really telling us by simply looking at unitary evolution and the decoherence that happens when you look at any portion of the universe, considering there's an entire universe out there, which is unavoidable. And if one looks at measurement-like interactions, that one might understand what's really going on in measurements. So many of course, started out early on simply looking at pre-measurements or entanglings between apparatus and system as a way of understanding what might be happening in measurement. And so for example, if you ended up with some Bell state as a result of interacting an apparatus with a system, then one might think that you would learn about what's happening in a measurement there. But the point of view of the decoherence approach is that, in fact, you can never avoid the environment. The environment is always there. It's always having some interaction with those two parts of the universe. And so what one's likely to, in fact, be dealing with is a situation where, for example, this would be more appropriately described as a reduced state of some larger system that evolves unitarily. And so the practical state that one might see, for example, keeping in mind that there could be a local environmental context, which is one generally speaking in this approach models in some way, one might end up with a GHZ type of state. In fact, in more recent results, Jurek has looked to these generalized GHZ states as a sort of perfectly redundant environment that he would ideally want in order to explain how it is that the classical world appears to us, or that measurements have outcomes which are stable and intersubjectively agreed upon. So when this point of view came forward, of course, and some people were very concerned about the problem which started beforehand. In fact, I don't know about Jurek's thinking, but of course one reason for thinking about an environment is the fact that if you believe this is what tells you what's going on in the measurement, is that in fact such an interaction will not give you, will not select out a preferred basis for the measurement. So they become different senses in which one might believe one's making a measurement, particularly of complementary observables at the same time, for example, because you don't have a preferred basis. So there was a sort of hopeful examination of these three system interactions in the 90s, and their various names, Boob, Clifton, and Elby, I believe, who were involved in this idea of looking at the generalized Schmidt decomposition as somehow a way to find the preferred basis in this context. Of course, Paris pointed out in one of his archive papers that, of course, there isn't always a generalized Schmidt decomposition once you go beyond the usual context of two systems. And so assuming such a decomposition is problematic, particularly as the number of systems is bigger. And so he pointed out, in fact, in his manuscript that he went about writing this little note because someone was planning to go off and write a paper in the decoherence approach, I believe, assuming that such a thing existed all the time.
Do you know how that's kind of like the measure of states which admit a trial orthogonal decomposition? And is it small or large?
So, well, it's not zero. There have to be particularly special conditions. So, it turns out that those conditions, I think, are not radically different from the conditions that Zurek is actually interested in. But nonetheless, the idea is that nature is supposed to be constantly measuring. You can't always assume that whatever interaction you have is a good measurement interaction. So I can't really recall the conditions for the existence of a generalized Schmidt decomposition, but it is fairly limited, and it's not a trivial step. And in fact, I don't know of anyone using that particular form and getting any mileage out of it. So I assume that it's not generally useful. But I think I might have passed on something a little quickly. Should have had another slide here. Right. So in fact, there is a different question or a different way that one might approach this issue, though, sort of sidestepping the whole question of the generalized Schmidt decomposition, which Bob talks about, which I'll get to eventually. So let me just mention what one believes is happening in the decoherence approach, if one's a believer, which is basically once you have this environment come into interaction with the apparatus in the system, that if one then traces out the environment, which, depending on the subtlety of the model, may be very small or very large. I'll actually talk about a few small ones. But of course, the universe is a very large place. And if you take the environment to be the entire environment of the universe, it will be very large. But the idea is that any kind of observation or measurement will be. This approach has been motivated by the idea that measurements are fairly localized things. And as a result, this is a perfectly natural thing to do when you want to understand what's the real state of the apparatus and system. So the claim of the decoherence approach is that in a good measurement, in fact, if you look at the reduced state of the system and apparatus, that that you'll have a diagonal one specifically in the representation which corresponds to the preferred basis. Now, it's not, in fact, the case that these generally are perfectly diagonal. So that's a problem with this move. Boob, on the other hand, pointed out what he calls the tri-decompositional theorem, which is that, in fact, you can have, in general, a decomposition of that form that was shown before, but it's not a Schmidt decomposition. In particular, the component states for the subsystems need only be linearly independent, not necessarily orthogonal, so it's not really a Schmidt decomposition. Such as this claim, and this also generalizes. Now, I haven't also heard many people making much distance of that, but if you look at his nice book, Interpreting the Quantum World, he has quite a lot of text on that. And then he believes, given the existence of this decomposition, that one can give an interpretation of quantum mechanics which works, which I don't know enough about to comment further on it. But anyway, this is a sort of foundational basis. It is true that this is a good. This is relevant to a good model environment, this idea that you might have environmental states that are not necessarily orthogonal in their decomposition, and these will be quite natural in what one finds in nature. For example, if you have a phonon bath environment, it's a reasonable way of looking at things. Right, and so if I'm here pointing out basically Bob's comments on this, he points out it's not full decoherence that's really important, in fact, specifically because of the existence of this P theorem in the way he can interpret it, but rather obtaining the preferred basis, at least approximately, is the important point from which one can then make interpretational use. So this is the overall decoherence approach, which again I'm not particularly advocating, but what I am advocating is the idea of examining these situations carefully in realistic cases to understand just how good an approximation the mathematics of it might be. Now, I don't know how much people know about the original Jurek paper where this whole business was spelled out. So I have a particularly good section from the text which we could go through. I think time is going on, so I should probably not spend time on this unless people are really interested. It's just a more careful statement of what I was just talking about. But again, the idea is that if you bring in the environment, in essence, once you bring in the environment, you do have a preferred basis, and you do understand that when you try to measure Z-spin, in fact, the apparatus states corresponding to your measurement of Z-spin will tell you, in fact, that that's what's happening. You can see that by looking at the reduced state of the apparatus and system after tracing out the environment. Okay, and this is actually an interesting thing from the more recent developments in this approach, which is actually just to focus on what's happening with the information in the situation here. Okay, this is 1981, and not too many people were really thinking about what happened to the information, where the information lay, so to speak, although I had some problems with that kind of statement. Okay, so nonetheless, this isn't the solution to the measurement problem, but presumably it's good physics that can tell us about nature and perhaps lead us to the foundation of quantum mechanics, or at least tell one where what we think of as the physical intuition will correspond nicely, or to work out nicely in a proper interpretation. So more recently, and I think this is even more pertinent to the problems that my group is working on now, is what's been called now the redundancy program or the redundancy paradigm that Jurek is pushing in Los Alamos. This particular paper is where these pictures are taken from. Basically, the idea is here's the first stage, the oldest step in history that I was talking about, system environment arrangement. And then if you think about the fact that the environment actually has a number of parts which might come into contact with the system over some period of time, he chooses this particular arrangement of environments, presumably for good reason, but I don't see the purpose of necessarily committing oneself just to examining things which are sort of independently in contact or even simultaneously in contact with the system. Nonetheless, the point is that there will be regions of the environment which can come in contact with the system either directly or indirectly, and one can think about the system plus its environment in more detailed ways to understand precisely, for example, what's happening to the information about the state of the system. Okay, and so this is the system, the situation which my group is looking at these days in some detail. First of all, just to develop an understanding of what's involved in decoherence by working on some simple problems, and then going on to attack this question, which I think is a central foundational question, which is that of the classical quantum boundary, to the extent such a thing exists, how flexible it is, how permeable it is in a way. And recent experiments have shown that, in fact, quantum effects can appear in quite surprising places. And so any simple idea that perhaps just scale is everything about the classical quantum boundary or any other particular single characteristic of the system is something which is open to question, is something I think that one can learn from by examining some more detailed models than one tended to in the past when trying to understand measurements, say, in the very simple schematic way I pointed out already. So, nonetheless, it's very interesting and valuable and important to look at different characteristics of systems that may be pertinent to the situation, say the system plus any one of those components that were surrounding it that I pointed out before, and seeing what happens if one considers, again, this basic fact that nothing is really isolated from the entire universe. So even those closest objects to the system, that might be the apparatus plus the observer plus some other things, for example, using observer in quotes because I don't believe that consciousness does anything particularly helpful in quantum mechanics.
Can you explain the notation?
Explain the notation. So this is just the n times tensor product of.
So the.
This is just a GHZ state for any number of. Yes.
And the other one n of them.
Yes. Yeah, so it's just, you know, like GHZ 000 plus 111, but just any number. So if you look at such a state, and again, this generally called generalized GHZ, but of course you can generalize in other ways by having unequal amplitudes, for example, in front. But this GHZ state is one that dephases linearly in the number of qubits. And so if you have this in the presence of some other, some larger environment, it is going to dephase in such a way that it dephases as a lot more quickly as the number of components increases. So if you're thinking about the system as being a spin, the apparatus as being a spin, the immediate environment being a spin, which is in fact what Jurek did in his 81 paper called the environment an atom, you would get a GHZ type of state. And then you could say, well, okay, but these three systems are in fact living in larger environment, and so the state will in fact dephase. So that would happen to his model if you looked at it in any detail. That's what you would see. For integral coherent states, you see dephasing rate that also increases with average number of photons, for example, in this coherent state. So that's how size may influence the coherency properties of systems which you can imagine scaling up from the traditionally quantum, which means the small, to what might be, in some people's minds, the boundary of quantum mechanical world before contacting the what one in some modes of thinking would be the classical world.
What's the difference between your first and your second? Isn't the second one just a special case of the first?
No.
But so
what? Because this is a coherent state. It's not a Fock state. Superposition, right?
Which is just because alpha is a different sort of state?
Alpha is a label for coherent state, which is a complex number, and there's a particular sort of Poisson distribution that one has. So this is not an index. This is a complex number. I'm assuming a certain familiarity with coherent states. It's just like laser.
Yeah, I know.
Most states.
Yeah.
So
the point is the alphas and minus alphas are not orthogonal.
Right, unless you have an infinite number of particles.
That's what makes it different from the first case.
Yeah, perhaps amongst other things, but certainly that's what I'm talking about here. So this is like two, if you imagine two laser modes that were, or two laser state output states that were entangled with one another in something like a singlet fashion, that's what I'm talking about here, which is a distinctly different thing from GHZ in general.
If alpha and minus alpha were
orthogonal,
you just have a special case of
right, but GHZ. The universe is finite, so. I guess it depends on how you. These are approximately orthogonal. This is a singlet state. This is. Well, so this doesn't have a fixed particle number either. So that's a. Anyway, there are differences between them, although you might say, well, they're not terribly different, so I'm not surprised by this. I'm just pointing out some facts that are known about states which are generally contemplated with a focus on what happens with size. One might have the impression that if your system gets bigger, it tends to decohere more rapidly. The same sorts of thing can be seen for disentanglement. And in fact, one of the sort of first results that our group has gotten out of studying some of these model systems that I'll get to at the end, hopefully, is that there's a specific relationship between decoherence in a preferred basis versus entanglement. And in fact, that one bounds the other. So, say before knowing that, one could go in and ask questions like, how does coherence behave with size? How does entanglement behave with size? So the disentanglement rate also increases with the number of subsystems for these generalized GHZ states as a reference for that. But they also point out that in cluster states, people have proposed for quantum computing that they in fact have an entanglement lifetime which is independent of n is the claim. Yes?
All the statements on this slide must be relative to some class of Hamiltonians and some splitting
So this is generally understood in terms of, imagine that you have dephasing noise, say, on each individual particle that you are looking at. Yes, that's very true, because in fact, there are ways in which this wouldn't be affected by what you'd consider noise. That's true, yeah. So thanks for pointing that out. I'm just putting out some sort of general statements that one could find in the literature. If you simply read the abstract or even read the entire papers, you'd come away with the impression that this is how these quantum systems behave as you sort of scale them up for the classical. So yes, thanks for pointing that out. That's a true thing. Okay, the cluster states seem to be an exception. And then that leads one to start to ask, well, in particular situations, is there, well, say, not particular situations, but for classes in particular Hamiltonians, what might happen to incoherence, what might happen to entanglement, and what's the relationship between them, if any. Temperature is also a consideration that people often think of in terms of, well, if I have an environment, what's this going to do to entanglement? I have a lot of time, but there's an argument which I find a little bit dodgy, although it seems pretty straightforward, about how entanglement must actually disappear at some finite temperature, which was given by Fine in this particular reference a couple of years ago. And the claim is that if you look at, an infinite temperature, if you look at any bipartite state description, you'll just end up with the identity, and that's surrounded by neighborhood separable states. Hence, entanglement is zero after some finite value, and therefore thermally bounding the entangled two-qubit states in a state more or less like that. So it's not so precise. This sort of general statement exists in literature. A particular examination by Seidinger's group for neighboring spins, interdimer correlations, and looking at what happens to the entanglement there, they have shown that, for example, at temperature of 5K, that you end up with more or less no entanglement between adjacent spins. So I just give this reference as an example of how people are trying to begin to understand the temperature influence on entanglement. Okay, but in my group, we're really starting out very simply and trying to develop a more perhaps complete picture by not necessarily assuming in the end that one is Hamiltonian is only a specific form, but quite a broad class of Hamiltonians that one could bring to bear on any particular model that one might have in the measurement process in the presence of the environment. And then we begin with basically environmental phase noise, which is the typical thing. You have a question?
So this actually issue was looked at also in the context of pseudo pure states of NMR, mm-hmm. liquid state NMR, mm-hmm. in caves, and some collaborators showed that these states are separable, mm-hmm. where the coefficient depends on the temperature of the mm-hmm. nuclear vat.
Right. I mean, so you can imagine if the temperature increases, that the effect of the environment is going to become more substantial. So I'm just putting these out as sort of just general background considerations that one often hears associated with the idea of making things classical. So that was the whole purpose of that. I'm not trying to present a particular argument, but I'm just contextualizing the particular example which I'm now going to show. And we decided to start looking at these problems because of the fact that Joe Eberle and Ting Yu, who is his collaborator at Rochester, started to examine two qubits under a limited set of different noise environments to see what happened to their coherency and their entanglement properties. And they got some somewhat surprising things and some not so surprising things. And we decided to extend that to the case of three qubits in order to precisely see if anything changes, just as the presumption was that if you go from thinking of system apparatus to system apparatus environment, that you might end up with a different situation. Now, again, this description here is the operator subdescription of some non-unitary evolution. And so their standard Krauss operators that correspond to dephasing, amplitude damping, and depolarization and so on. We're looking at just local phase damping effects. This is an exact calculation. And from that, one can see a general relationship between dephasing and disentanglement.
So what is gamma?
Gamma. So gamma is, I'll show you what gamma is in detail, but this is basically an expression of how strong the damping is. So if you dephase a qubit, of course, this is the sort of picture we're probably all familiar with seeing through a preferred basis, as you can see here. And I will show you as much detail as necessary for defining these things as we go along. There's a certain limit at which even I'm tired of looking at big arrays of representation of the cross operators and so on. But the general result, sorry?
The previous slide, was P and K the same thing, or was there some relation?
These are the cross operators, yes. Oh, sorry about that. So these should be K's, that's right.
K's,
yeah, right. Sorry about that. It's a historical accident of how this slide was prepared. Right, so those should be the K's. In general, one might have different sorts of, well, this is a single qubit, but we're going to talk about two and three qubits, and in that case, one can think of the cross operator, and that can be broken down actually into different components. So you can represent these cross operators as products of other ones, and so that's how that came historically. Right, so it was noticed that entanglement is bounded by coherence in the preferred basis, and I put that with hyphens precisely because that's the thing that one wants to think of. It's very important when talking about coherence to understand precisely what you mean. You mean coherence on any basis or in a specific basis, right? And that distinguishes dephasing, say, from depolarization. So it was noticed by you and Everly that entanglement is bounded by coherence in a preferred basis under local phasing noises. And they chose some what they called representative pairs of states which cover almost all examples, which is basically just to take all, you know, the standard basis for a pair of qubits and then choose particular ones which more or less include, you know, two examples, one which includes, let's say, the phi plus minus case and one which includes the psi plus psi minus case. And so, of course, psi minus is decoherence-free subspace for global dephasing. And so you expect that to be more robust, whereas the phi states are fragile under global dephasing simply because the phases are pointing in the same direction in the components that one has. And so it's more or less the same as looking at a single qubit. They just are acted on in unison simultaneously. Did you have a question?
I have two questions about this slide. First is, so entanglement, at least bipartite entanglement, is a well-defined measure. But what is the kind of quantitative measure of coherence you're using?
Right. So,
where does the bound go? Is it an upper bound?
Oh, yes, sorry. So, I mean, bounded from the sort of, you know, bound by above sense. Of, in fact, so the coherence will last longer than the entanglement. And that may or may not be surprising, right? From general considerations, you'd say, well, okay, that's not surprising because I don't have entanglements, I don't have phases, so if there's some special phases that I need to have, then of course the entanglement should, in general, of course, disappear beforehand. But this is dephasing in a particular basis, and so that's a little bit more specific set of phases that one considers, at least intuitively speaking. And for the measure of decoherence, basically one looks at the lifetime of decay of off-diagonal elements.
Reasonable exponential processes, you're just looking at the rates?
Well, so one would expect that that's so, but as it turns out, it's not always so. It depends on which states you start with, and that's actually one of the interesting things that's come up, which I'll show in a couple of slides. So it's not necessarily, in fact, exponential decay. You can have what's called entanglement sudden death, which is that you have entanglement for a certain amount of time, and then suddenly it will go to zero. And if you look, if you use concurrence as the measure, for example, which is a perfectly legitimate one, you'll see that the concurrence goes to zero at some finite time for certain classes of mixed states, which includes particular Brenner states, for example, and also the maximally entangled mixed states, which Quiot's group, for example, and I believe White's group spend a lot of time thinking about. So these are pure states. And in fact, the analysis that we did was focusing on particular classes of known pure states because the idea was to take some system which is entangled, right, put some dephasing noise on it, see what happens to the coherence, what happens to the entanglement. And so we found that you'll have coherence longer than you'll have entanglement if there's any loss at all. I mean, in some cases, you have a decoherence-free subspace. You're not going to have decoherence. You're not going to have disentanglement if you choose the right. So does that answer your two questions?
Almost. Okay. I still understand how they're both in the same unit or something like that. It's not a time scale.
It is a time scale. Okay, yeah, so I'll show you impacts and plots for disentanglement and sudden death for different cases, although, yeah, so anyway, as long as you have off-diagonal elements, there's some degree of coherence, right, as long as, yes. So if you have definite phases in there, then you'll have coherence. And so that's the sense in which this discussion goes on. Right, so under local dephasing noises, which are independent, these states turn out to be fragile, and you'll see that this includes, I've crossed out the one which isn't included here, because of course you have four possibilities between the two, right? So then you have your plus, 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 minus, and the minus plus is not there, so you don't have your entanglement-free state present here. I mean, your decoherence-free state present here. So this tends to be fragile. And if you look at the stand-in for the k's, which I showed before, cross operators for the local noises and for the global noise, you can actually have three types of noise acting on a pair of qubits of the dephasing type of noise. In this particular case, the assumption was that there wasn't any global noise. These are the original results of Yu and Eberle that sort of inspired us to start to look at this in more complicated situations. So, Eberle, being a very good physicist who worked in practical optics for a long time, was not terribly surprised by the behavior, particularly if you assume that the degree of phasing is the same, dephasing is the same for the part A and the part B components of your joint state, that in fact the entanglement ends up being precisely half of that. So that was their original result. So what we wanted to do is see what happens if you say, well, okay, now imagine I have three qubits, and in case of three qubits, there are more possibilities for noise sources. And this is what I have a lot of material to show later if we have time with. But the general conclusion we found was that you have the same behavior. That if you have dephasing noise, it doesn't matter what kind of dephasing noise you have. If there's dephasing at all, if there's decoherence at all, the entanglement dies more rapidly, goes down more rapidly in magnitude with time than does the coherence. And in particular, you have this entanglement sudden death. So even if you say, well, there's some scaling issue, I don't know if you're comparing for different sorts of measures, concurrence versus coherence, and if they're both exponential, well, maybe I could imagine them both being simply rescaled in some way, that it wouldn't be any difference. But with entanglement sudden death, which I'll show you in a second, then it's clearly the case that the coherence persists indefinitely, but the entanglement is lost. And this is interesting, again, in the context of imagining, modeling, measurement, or some environmental situation where there might be a system that you might imagine as being monitored and therefore, in some sense, measured by the environment, which is the ultimate reason for looking at these things. So I'll get to this back in more detail, but if you look, well, I tried to explain that in the Yu and Eberle case, that basically they examined the entangled states that were available, and they tried to put dephasing noise on them to see what would happen. And they noticed a difference which wasn't surprising between, say, the state which was, you know, included a component which was the Bell-Phi states versus the singlet state component. And they saw differences there. So if we were going to three qubits, then the question of what would be the natural states to start with to act on with the environment. And we chose the W class and the GHZ class. And of course, the GHZ class, if you're looking at bipartite entanglement between subcomponents, we didn't actually go and look at the bipartite decomposition between, say, one qubit and the other two qubits collectively, which we could have done. But we looked at the bipartite two qubit bits inside, and of course, if you looked at the reduced state of any two qubits in the GAZ state, it's already decohered and disentangled, so there's nothing interesting there. Although, this is what Jura tells you you should get if you have a good measurement, so in that sense, it's actually interesting. And in the case of the W state, again, we found this bounding, but again, one can dispute as to the importance of that unless one considers the entanglement sudden death question. And here there's clearly distinct sorts of behavior. So the idea, and this is in fact something that you and Everly produced while we were in the process of calculating our results, they made it quite clear that you can lose your entanglement completely but still retain coherence if you choose the right sort of state. So they took what they call a standard class of states, which happens to include the Wiener states and the MEMS states. If you take the Z to be zero, then this describes a Wiener state of the phi plus type, so linear combination of the weighted superposition of the weighted combination of the identity and the phi state. Then what happens in the case of global dephasing noise is that if you examine the time-dependent version, I put a little prime on here, the time-dependent version of the concurrence, you see in fact that concurrence goes to zero at some specific time, which is borne out. Here you should see that. All right, so this one, of course, right. The important and interesting one here is the second component, the magnitude of the, what is the stand-in for the W. So it's this component of the density matrix, which is time evolved. And you can see that this is becoming smaller as a result, that this will end up being describing your concurrence, and it goes to zero. Whereas if you look at the case where either B or C is zero, then in fact you have this exponential type of decay. And that would be a case where, for example, you had a Wiener state which was with the decoherence-free subspace type state. So in other words, there was a sub-ensemble which was made up of singular states, and in fact you will not completely lose your entanglement for finite times. It will persist. So I don't know if people are interested to know what a maximally entangled mixed state is, but if you look at the tangled versus linear entropy, the MEM states, and in fact these are, there's an ansatz for what those things are. They have a particular form, and then you can sort of map them out in this plane, and this is what Kwiat was able to do, just numerically finding out where those ought to lie. And you see that these are of the form I showed before, and so that's what those were. Okay, so what's the whole, again, motivation for going about this before I show you the details of what happens in the three qubit case, if there's time and interest? So one of the reasons why I think this is worth going on with, because in some ways it's a fairly simple exercise. You simply say, oh, I've got this sort of dephasing noise. You turn the crank on a nice operator sum decomposition with known types of noise, and then you get your resulting density matrix after the operation of the noise. It's a fairly straightforward exercise. So what's the actual physics in it? How is this going to tell us anything about what's happening in some states that would be models for measurement or the natural behavior of the environment, which is measurement like? And I think that the entanglement sudden death is a significant thing. Yes?
That's a very general question. When you talk about time, what does that mean? Does that mean you just keep repeating, applying this noise operator many times, and time is the number of times you've applied it?
Right. Well, so the idea is that you have a phonon back, right, and it has a certain strength, and it persists over time. So.
But I mean, calculationally, what are you doing? Are you, do you have a time parameter in your noise operator, or are you?
Yes. Those are noise. Those are time-dependent noises, and I'll show you that when I actually get into the details of it, exactly how they go, and so on. But yes, I mean, there's a time parameter to those noises. Okay. So right. So the idea is that you're going to find conditions like this in nature. I mean, you can't assume. Well, I suppose one could assume, but in general, one would have to have very good ground for assuming that any particular environment that you may start to describe, apparatus system, and say sub-environment, any particular situation, would be necessarily in a pure state when you come upon it, or in any sense, perhaps. So
what is it, this whole thing depends on the interpretation of what a mixed state is, right? Whether it solves the problem of classical transition. And what I'm just kind of wondering this thought, whether you're describing the environment as noise. So you're describing it by a mixed state. Somebody might argue that the environment in any given case is a particular state. This is related to the general claims about the decoherent solving the measurement problem.
Right. Okay. So
it's that's the kind of analysis. I'm wondering how you're thinking about this.
Right. So that's an important point. So how I'm thinking about it is that along the lines of the redundancy paradigm, which is that there's a system, and then there's an environment which immediately surrounds the environment, then there's the rest of the universe, right? And so the rest of the universe is filled with fields. If you look at results of people in who really believe the decoherence approach is the way to go, they'll make claims that, you know, the cosmic microwave background does serious things to the quantum states. So I'm talking about any kind of model that you'd imagine for measurement in any laboratory that you could construct, say on Earth, right? And say, okay, this is my model for measurement, and I've got my system, I have my immediate apparatus which measures, and then I've got the rest of the laboratory. And then there's the ambient environment, for example. Right. So that's actually a very good point, that, right? I mean, this is very close to the original point of view of Zurek in 81, that he can imagine thinking of the environment as one atom, right? I mean, that's not realistic at all, but that's what he was doing in his original paper. He said, okay, I've got an environment and that's an atom. And okay, so then you can start to get, you know, then you can say, well, I'm going to be more realistic, or you can say, I'm going to be ideal and I'm going to talk about the whole universe, the state of which I could never know anyway. So at that point, you have to give me a reason for saying that that should be even.
But in the pure world, that environment is described as a pure state or a mixed state?
So, in the way that I've laid this problem out, the kind of analyses that I was looking at, with the exception of the intentional sudden death case, those were initially pure states. Say, the result of the initial interaction before the larger environment started to act. Right? So, so in the U and Everly treatment of two qubits, then you could say this is the system and the apparatus, and then the environment is the noise, and then I look at what happens to the system and the apparatus. Right. And then in the three-qubit analysis, what you're talking about is imagining system, apparatus, and local environment, say, and then the remainder of the universe.
It seems to me that...
So, but these are all open state noise
right.
evolutions, so yeah?
Sudden death or not, one universe or many universes. Mm-hmm. No matter what you do, in the end, it's completely reversible process, what you're doing. So why should there...
What's completely reversible? Everything I've done has been involved in external noise, and it's a non-unitary.
If you consider all of that, it's totally reversible.
The phenomenological model you're using is irreversible, but if we imagine
right.
that phenomenological mm-hmm. model is really the effective action of some, it's really the effective action of some unitary and extended Hilbert space
mm-hmm.
where everything's pure and unitary.
Right.
And I think that's what you mean, right? That ultimately, this is just modeling
what you know.
Some process. It's kind of this church with larger Hilbert space issue.
Exactly, and I'm not taking the position of any church here at all. And I'm saying, imagine I have quantum mechanics and I know it works very well. Anything that I've ever done in any experiment on whatsoever,
yeah.
And even if I take myself out and I call myself the greater environment, right, in some sense, then I could talk about the entire rest of the universe. But if you want, I'm not here, you know, not trying to in any way forward the decoherence interpretation. I try to make that clear at the outset. Okay, in no sense am I trying to do that. So all I have to do is to say that I have, you know, three parts and then a fourth part, which is the environment, whose behavior I don't know. That's all, right? So
I think that the some people like me get disturbed by the word classical there. So I would say something like,
okay, so I qualified that before. I haven't spoken about that line yet, right? But I qualified that by saying entanglement loss. And when I describe in quantum mechanics the state of the system, I have to consider its reduced state unless I have some ideological reason for doing otherwise. If I want to describe some system, I should describe it if I know some description of the larger system, right? Technically, I would describe that by the reduced state. So what I'm saying is that if you have some reduced state, and there's no longer any entanglement, in that sense it's classical because all the correlations are classical, at which point one could reasonably introduce the idea of thinking of the probabilities that appear, for example, in the diagonal as being due to ignorance rather than anything else.
Right. More than so, you can't violate a Bell's inequality at that point anymore. Right? There's no.
Right. So, I mean, I don't have any particular fixation on Bell, right? But
I mean, you can define classicality as not being able to
violate a Bell's. Right. So, I mean, sure. In some sense, it's the same thing, right? So that's what I'm trying to point out. At some point, if you believe that there's any distinction between. If you think the quantum correlations are described by concurrence, then concurrence goes to zero. Then you don't have anything specifically quantum anymore. You have only non-quantum correlations. If you don't believe there's a distinction between the two, and that's perfectly reasonable, I suppose, then that's so. But I believe what I'm doing is quite orthodox and pragmatic and non-ideological and so on. I'm simply trying to put a little meat on the bones of the redundancy program here. Right? So that's the overall picture. So this particular problem wasn't necessarily taken on for the sole purpose of analyzing the decoherence approach, because if I were going to criticize it, I would do it on a philosophical grounds, right? And not by constructing some model which is perfectly acceptable, which isn't, and then doing a bad job of setting up the parameters, right, and then trying to make some crazy claim, which probably is not abnormal, but that's not my style.
What's the physical problem? That you, whatever you do, you're going to have a diagonal current. That's not what happens in many.
Right. So well. Right. So I did show, and part of the results that I can show anybody who's interested, because we probably run out of time or interest or whatever. But I showed quite clearly that if you start with the GHZ state, which is the ideal redundant example, because you know every single component. If you want to push this model, a little out of the context of what I'm talking now, and just say I have, you know, a chain of elements of the environment leading from the object to the observer or wherever you want, right? That you'll have perfect correlation between, you know, what you're using here is the state that represents the information in that original qubit, right? All the way through the entire chain. So in that sense, it's as redundant as one can get. And for him, this is the ideal of the measurement. And if you look at that state, that just falls back into one of the original cases I studied out at the beginning, right, which is the GHZ state generalized. And you know, then you can start to ask yourself, well, OK, so if this is subject to dephasing noise, the bigger it gets, the quicker it's going to dephase. And so Zurek would like that. So in that sense, I'm confirming that maybe what he already knew about the physics before he set up the interpretation, right? That in fact those are very good states for doing precisely what he wants. And if you want to think about it from the informational point of view, the claim is that the information which is present in the state, the information about the state, is transferred in the environment out, and hopefully, preferably, as redundantly as possible throughout the system. Now there are issues which I want to spend more time thinking about that I haven't, about monogamy of entanglement and so on, what's really going on, in what sense do you have the information that you want as strongly as possible presented throughout the environment. I think if you look at the general picture that's being presented here, what you see is classical correlations between subsystems and redundancy of, in that sense, redundancy of information. And that as you go through this chain of interaction from the system outwards into the environment that the entanglement is present in the sort of moves from the locality of the original system, and with each other, with each measurement, and as you sort of think about the enlarged system that it's created, the entanglement will sort of be present further and further away from the system. And meanwhile, the environment close to the system and within that chain becomes correlated with the system to the extent that it's a good measurement and looks like a GHZ type of state. And then again, if you look at the, if you follow what he said, and you take, okay, my system plus greater apparatus, which may be some number of subsets, of, you know, some number of systems which are a subset of this whole chain, that in fact the reduced state of that will be precisely what he claimed and will be diagonal. The question is, does that really happen in nature? And I don't think nature makes GHZ states vary automatically. That's the question. He would say that an environment which does a good job of measuring things probably should do that. But because I'm not following, you know, I'm not on the track of supporting his position, I haven't thought about those things in all that much detail. I'm not trying to support his point here. I'm rather using the fact of the arrangement that he suggests to look at some realistic environments and ask, do these describe measurement situations or not?
No, but then the great question is, what do you mean by foundational?
Well, so, I mean, okay, so in what sense can any calculation in quantum mechanics tell you really anything foundational other than perhaps the examples that we know? I mean, even Bell's theorem, how really foundational is that?
Well,
I'm trying, you know, to make you think a little bit more deeply, right? It's just a standard quantum state which tells you something surprising in terms of your prejudices. Right?
Well, yes, that's
okay.
True. But it's so, more than this. Let me think. I think the statement now.
I'm trying to make it more. You want a foundation, so I'm giving you foundation.
Sure, it's about our prejudices of what we think about locality and non-locality. Mm-hmm. But it is more than that. Quantum mechanics is just one of the theories that we have in physics. And the other theory, which is equally respectable, even more respectable, is telling you something completely different about locality and non-locality.
Which theory is that? QED?
I'm not even going to... So then the question is, then in at least in my view, Bell's theorem is very powerful.
Well, okay. It's clearly of the first rank of technical results that one can get in quantum mechanics that tells something about the nature of the physics, and maybe precisely being surprising means to be foundational. But, you know, if you think foundations is about finding out what is the ultimate reality behind formalism, then it's not clear that any particular calculation will be the most, well, the calculations in general will be helpful. I think that rather one has to do philosophical analysis to. And that's what one should be doing mostly, or at least understanding the way that theories are used. It's referred to a conversation that I've had with some people here that perhaps is really what the question of the foundation of physics is, right? How, in fact, pragmatically are theories used, and what do people think they're doing when they're using a particular theory? So I don't think that one shouldn't expect anything other than to learn more physics from doing it. Quantum mechanical calculation, and then if these calculations, and these calculations will bear on claims of people who have particular biases that are using calculations to support those biases, which is what's happening with the decoherence approach. In that sense, the whole thing is a foundational exercise. I'm trying to give a broader context to something which is a pretty straightforward calculation, but nonetheless is publishable and interesting and my student's first project, so.
You're trying to focus in on this, you know, why a single outcome occurs aspect.
I don't understand what is foundational in here.
Well, I think how I would defend it, which is just to extend what you've said, which is that if you take the, a many-worlds type ontology, you have this preferred basis for all. Now, I don't espouse that, but what this does is it says, can you really, does it really give you a unique ontology, which is the one in which the density matrix is diagonal? And those states are going to be preferred states, and they're somehow, you just have a classical mixture of those.
Yeah.
So
I
accept. That's the way.
So if you have a certain interpretation, if this helps in that interpretation, then it's foundational.
Right, and also my focus also pointed out right. My focus was the quantum classical transition in the boundary, and I'm taking it this particular sense in which I'm claiming that something classical is emerging, which is that you're losing quantum correlations, and you're generating classical correlations between systems in the world, right? So, I mean, one could think about this more deeply, maybe in some kind of Copenhagenist way, and say, well, okay, so if I've got my system, and then I had my apparatus and they entangled, right, and then there's an environment, and then if I trace out the system and the apparatus, and I ask what is that state, and I find out that after some time it's classical, maybe precisely that sense that the system has become classical and that it has a definite value, which I know, right, and one can try doing things like that. But I'm simply saying that one can see classicality emerging in a system as it's enlarged in a very specific sense. And I'm not trying to make any, you know, huge broad claims here, but I'm just pointing out that, like any interesting calculation in quantum mechanics, one can compare it to one's intuition or claims of a particular philosophical school or interpretational school which makes use of calculations related to it to forward its position. So that's the point of the exercise, even though it's, you know, fairly simple bit of open systems.
There's something that everyone agrees with, which is that quantum systems in some circumstances can be described by classical probabilities and not by quantum amplitudes, independent of your deeper interpretation.
The mathematics, what those probabilities
really mean in terms of what really exists is another question that's somehow more foundational. But the question is, why does interference go away and you just see probabilities? It's a sort of well-posed mathematical problem that has some foundational aspect to it. It's important in understanding the relationship between the two theories. In what sense is a classical theory? Like you might like, maybe I'll read it later, but I've always had a confusion about gases. Why are gases described so classically when things are really quantum, when molecules are really quantum?
In the beginning of quantum mechanics, not everybody believed that atoms existed, right? I mean, some set of the physics
people.
Well, okay, but I mean, when I believe the late 19th century, there were, you know, a very large number of people who were not sure that atoms actually existed. So, anyway, this is a historical point, which is not the main thing. So this is what the form of the gamma is. So there's a certain dephasing, natural dephasing time, which is built in here. So in that sense, the coherence, the description of the decoherence is, you know, it's by construction in a sense. Right? So here's the time dependence of those gammas. And then you understand that for a single qubit, for example, that you will get the time out in a natural way. Right? But when you start to look at larger environments and you say, well, okay, so we're running out of time, right? So just to show you what actually went on and what you have to do and why this isn't entirely trivial, right, is that if you think about a three-qubit system which can encounter all forms of purely phase noise, these are the combinations of environments that's possible, or components of the environment that's possible for three qubits to feel. So if you want to describe a purely phasing, this is the way you can do it. We made the Markov approximation, which is in line with what you and Everly had done before. So from the sort of diagrammatic point of view, these are the different combinations one can look at. And if you examine all of them, you'll find out that that the entanglement decays more rapidly than the coherence. And that was a sort of general conclusion, in addition to the sort of obvious things about what would be the reduced state of two components and so on. So, and then just a bit of that. So I think that'll end the sort of formal presentation. It's been an hour, right? But if you want to have any more discussions, I'm open for them.
Yeah.